Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind with Robin Pierce, Jessica Burtis, Pamela Sue Mann, Kathy Manzo, Alex Lefchuk, and more, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today. The ever-dwindling population, because quite frankly, we're still in the pandemic era.
A planet where apes evolved from men? There's got to be an answer.
Don't look for it, Kayla. You may not like what you find.
Damn you all to hell!
The year, 3955. Charlton Heston as Taylor, a 20th century astronaut, space wrecked in the incredible future. Linda Harrison as Nova, a savage beauty from the enslaved and voiceless human race.
They're marked for target practice.
James Franciscus as astronaut Brent, on a reckless mission to rescue Taylor, trapped by the swaggering, brutal master race of apes who dominate the Earth, a planet shattered by the atomic war of a distant, forgotten past.
Into the Forbidden Zone. Someone or something has outwitted the intelligence of the gorillas.
Invade! Invade!
Face the terrifying dangers of the Forbidden Zone with them. Engulfing you in the shattering experiences that await beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Well, there's an intelligence working in this place. They know we're here.
We are determined to know what the apes want. War or peace?
The super intelligent mutants. Are they human or something else? In their church, an unspeakable god.
A doomsday bomb.
Behind their faces, an unbearable secret.
We don't kill our enemies. We get our enemies to kill each other.
The irresistible war machine of the guerrilla army versus the devastating secret mind weapons of the subterranean mutants in civilization's final battle to answer the ultimate question. Can a planet long endure, half human and half ape? Is it the beginning or the end?
Beware the beast man, for he is the devil's pawn. Alone among God's primates, he kills for sport, or lust, or greed. Yea, he will murder his brother to possess his brother's land. Let him not breed in great numbers, for he will make a desert of his home and yours. Shun him, for he is the harbinger of death. Strong words indeed from the lawgiver. Time for a Resonant Rewind.
Thank you. Well, there we are. Music by Leonard Rosenman. And he went on to, of course, work for some of the Star Trek material in times to come. Notwithstanding, of course, the fact that before, as far as Beneath the Planet of the Apes is concerned, Ted Post would also go on to direct those immortal words, "Do you feel lucky, punk? Well, do you?" And, of course, he directed Clint Eastwood and David Soule in Magnum Force. Paul Dane, of course, the writer, also did the screenplay for Goldfinger. So they coped very well with a budget that was slashed left, right and centre as we went beneath the Planet of the Apes. And the only Soule who's actually with us, aptly really, when you bear in mind the ending of the film, is Robin Pierce. Robin, here we are, a budget sequel which used the sets of Hello Dolly for 20th Century Fox because the company had already more or less bankrupted itself with Hello Dolly and indeed the wonders of Dr. Doolittle. Here, of course, we have Beneath the Planet of the Apes. What were your initial thoughts on this little opus?
Okay, I'm glad you said, what are your initial thoughts? Because I hadn't seen this film for about 20 years. And beginning of this week, I thought, okay, we're doing the second one, but I want to rewatch the first one. And then I thought I might as well rewatch all of them and get the whole saga done one a day during this week. And I'm really glad I did because it's actually made me reassess the impressions that I had from my last viewing. And I think more crucially, because you said that the budget had been slashed, I was watching them on Blu-ray. So, you know, my eyes were open, the screen was large, the definition was high. Show me what you got and see if you can impress me. And I knew that the budget had been slashed. I knew this. But apart from a few scenes, group scenes of, you know, when the gorillas are organizing their militia, I thought the makeup actually worked better than I thought. And bear in mind, I'm watching in a format that would allow them no error here. But as far as Beneath the Planet of the Apes itself goes, it followed Planet of the Apes, obviously, which was made in 67, 68, and we're now in 1970. And I think it was a brilliant sequel because looking at it through my now 62-year-old eyes, I kind of thought it sidestepped very neatly what sequels tend to do. Where, you know, this worked for the original film, give them more of the same, they'll be happy, they'll come and see it. And during the first part of the film, you think, another astronaut, 6 months after Charlton Heston landed, why would they even send another astronaut? You know, because they didn't even know he'd gone lost yet. And it's always bugged me why these guys are trained astronauts. They're walking around in some scenes in the dark. They don't have the common sense to look up at the constellations, figure out, wow, they look awfully familiar. And they're in just the right places. But of course, that would have taken away from Rod Serling's unique ending. So to get back to the original point here, we've got Trent, played by James Franciscus, landing the same place that, more or less, Charlton Heston landed, except he didn't land in a lake. And we think it's going to be more of the same. He's in the Forbidden Zone. And yeah, it's like same old, same old. He's going to meet the apes and all this. And yeah. But it takes a dramatic turn because we don't know what's happened to Taylor's character. We know he's met some kind of wall of flame. And he sent Nova, played by Linda Harrison, to look for Cornelius and Zira, Kim Hunter, Roddy McDowell. She comes across the Trent character, Brent, something ends in ENT, character. And she takes him to Ape City. And that's where we take the dramatic turn, where the apes are organizing their militia. They want to wipe out the humans in the Forbidden Zone. These are the same mutated humans who have developed a kind of hallucinogenic hypnosis, which has convinced Charlton Heston's character that he was facing a wall of flame. And they live underground, old New York City, which has been, of course, obliterated. And they have mutated. They're incredibly deformed under their life masks, and they worship a bomb. Now, this so much plays into the fears that America had at the time. We see anti-war protesters. We see the militia organizing. It's almost like a metaphor for Vietnam. We see some characters get better developed. Now, go into this later on when we do the favorite character part than they ever were in the first film. The performances in this are absolutely great, I thought. The effects still stand up. The story, though, it does that one thing that a lot of movies in the 70s did, was have an incredibly downbeat ending. And, of course, the button gets pressed, cobalt bomb goes off, kaboom, everybody dies. Until the profits of the film are seen. And even though the film's diminished budget-wise, film after film after film, the way they brought the whole thing round full circle, so by the end of the fifth installment, Battle for the Planet of the Apes, we're almost back where we started from. And that, to me, in the 1970s, was mind equals completely blown. And I was so happy. I don't know if I've reverted back a few years, but I was so happy that despite the fact that I recollected what was going to happen, that I enjoy the films more now than I thought I would. And it still had the capacity to blow my mind through its sheer inventiveness. And, you know, I've got nothing but kudos for all five films. Now, if you'd have asked me the same question last week before my complete re-evaluation for these series, I'd have said, you know, the first one was great, then they get worse and worse and worse until it's not worth bothering with. But this is me recanting humbly here. To the lawgiver, I apologize.
Well, we heard the words of the lawgiver at the start of this particular piece, but let's turn to our Miami-based religious expert, Kathy Manso. Kathy, your thoughts on the Alpha and Omega and this little opus for this week's Resonance Rewind.
Okay, so I did the exact opposite of Robin, and I came in with this absolutely no knowledge, knew nothing, didn't research. I just was like, I'm going to hope for the best. Like, I know the concept of Planet of the Apes, so I'm not completely too lost on it, but I'd never seen this film before, and I just kind of wanted to surprise myself, see what my genuine reaction was, and there are twists, which I was not prepared to get from this. And I do agree with you with the makeup. I was thinking, I was like, this is actually pretty good for when this came out. Like, I was impressed to see that as well. Although I think it would have been a very comical break the fourth wall situation if someone took off their mask. It's like they're hiding in the crowd. but, you know, for later. but I think it's a lot of entertainment. I was definitely keeping at the edge of my bed when I was watching this. And exactly as Robin said, I turned off all the lights. I had the nice TV on, really focused my attention on this. And I had a good time, and especially with so much of the messages coming clearly through. I mean, I love seeing my hippie guys going out there being like, peace. I was like, yeah, there should be. That'd be great. Thanks. but yeah, I'm going to have a positive reaction to this. So I feel good time coming, guys.
It's remarkably short, I think, 90 minutes or just over 90 minutes. So clearly, in comparison to the first movie, which was about just over 2 hours, they've certainly shortened the systems there. What about, Kathy, the kind of parallel with, shall we say, a certain Russian-Ukrainian scenario, which inevitably I seem to think did tend to resonate with the character of Ursus, played by James Gregory, known, of course, for being a psychiatrist in the Dagger of the Mind episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, I had a lot of conflicting feelings with that specific character because I understood and I didn't understand. But I'll get into that later. I think, well, here's the thing, especially for when this came out, there's going to, I think you can always compare these kind of films whenever there's a war going on. I mean, currently the one that's globally known, as well as other wars, not just Ukraine or Ukraine and Russia, like you have so many happening, whether it be civil unrest in Iran or, you know, and so on and so forth in so many different countries. But I think there's always going to be those kind of two sides, the people who think they have to fight and the people that think that it's not necessary. There's other ways to get to the solution. And I think this just kind of shows a very human problem, because you can even take this kind of theme and use this with any sort of, you know, fight that's between people. You know, when someone can see so clearly that they're correct and they can't be convinced, and it's a series of upbringing, morals and principles and life experiences that kind of keep that, which is why two very conflicting sides can kind of crash because of completely different life experiences.
There were a number of areas which I thought were intriguing. First of all, we did actually have at the end of the movie, and perhaps an ultimate irony, that the person who actually blows up the world is indeed a human being, the person who actually pulls the trigger, despite the guerrillas effectively wanting to pull down the bomb. It's ultimately Charlton Heston with, as we saw in Soylent Green, the classic Charlton Heston hand movement, a bloodied hand held up before he presses the button. Clearly from his cold, dead hands, wasn't just his real-life approach that he was taking to the National Rifleman's Association. But we also saw a number of key areas in terms of, I thought, the sauna scene for the orangutan and the gorilla was intriguing. And also the tacit acceptance that Cornelius played, I have to say, in to fine form, given that Roddy McDowall wasn't available for this. And I felt that actually the actor who took on board the role of Cornelius actually did a very capable, almost superb Roddy McDowall-esque job at incarnating Cornelius. That was David Watson. But there was that notion that wife or chimpanzee beating was actually acceptable in order to actually deal with a partner who effectively didn't agree with the dominant ideology of the time and obviously was refusing to support the guerrillas. This was when Dr. Zaius obviously visits them and he says he just beat her again. So a number of areas there which I thought were a little bit problematic. Did you feel that they were of the time acceptable, or was it just a case of, well, we knew that Cornelius would never really hurt Zira, it was just an act?
Ah, right. Well, I think it was just an act because, you know, ape shall not kill ape. And we can extrapolate from that that they don't beat each other up much either, unless they're gorillas. I'd like to backtrack just a little bit. I mean, Kathy made some really, really good points and pertinent ones there. But when I was watching General Ursus today, bear in mind it's been 20 years, I was seeing more Trump and his riding the wave of popularity, populism, in order to achieve his own ambitions, which were not necessarily in tune with what was best for the country. And I thought, wow, that's kind of eerily prophetic, as eerily prophetic as in Battle for the Planet of the Apes, somebody says a word that is forbidden to say to an ape, and he almost gets put to death for it. It was like, wow.
Cancel culture,
wokeism, before it even became invented. And that film was made in 1973. So I was seeing more the whole Trump administration as being the guerrillas. It's like our way, we will beat down whatever we've got to beat down in order to do what we feel like doing right now. we don't care if you voted for this or not. We're going to do it because we're in power. The other thing was, as you said, Alex, about David Watson essaying the role of Cornelius. He did it to such effect that when I saw this film in the 70s and possibly on TV in the 80s and 90s, I didn't realize for a while that it wasn't Roddy McDowall because he sounded so convincing. And I later found out that on a lot of the publicity materials for Beneath the Planet of the Apes, which I would have seen at that time, they mistakenly put Roddy McDowall's image as Cornelius on the publicity material, which would have added to the confusion or the illusion. You decide.
It was also nice to actually spot some wonderful roles by Victor Buono, of course, known as King Tut in Batman, and of course Mr. Schubert in a series we've yet to look at, which is of course Man from Atlantis.
Victor Buono not look horribly sinister and baby-like bald? You know, he looked like a baby who was going to eat you.
Indeed, yes. And Jeff Corey, of course, who also was in the Cloud Dwelling episode of Star Trek and so on. Kathy,
best eyebrows in the business.
Exactly. Back to yourself, Kathy, in terms of the ways in which we had them. I mean, again, I thought there were some wonderful individual shots here when the apes actually discovered the mutant Albina, and her position was pretty much the identical shape of the death of Marat, the French libertarian. And person who basically was arguing for the freedom of the press back in the French Revolution, with the sort of the bath scene scenario there. Did you feel it kind of it wove you into a role in which actually, whether it was James Franciscus as Brent, or indeed Nova with her one word, which was so critical when she uttered it, or was it a case of you kind of bonded more with the Dr. Zaius or Cornelius Azira and so on?
Yeah, it's kind of a hard one, because I took this movie more of a whole than I did with certain like relationships, I suppose. Like, I think you're just like so curious to find out how is this going to unfold, trying to find this mystery astronaut, and then you get like twists in the middle, being like, oh, this underground hidden group of telepathic people. No, like you, which I found that whole aspect to be really intriguing and would wonder how the plot would do with or without it. But I think when it comes to following it, I think I had a very uncomfortable feeling with Nova because of her previous relationship with the other astronaut, where I was like, I do not like this. I am not a fan, when they did the flashbacks. But when she's with George Taylor, the American astronaut, I was like, okay, he's truly like trying to figure out what has happened to the missing astronaut. Where is he and how does he get out of here? Because this is worst case scenario. Like, I think he has the appropriate reaction to finding out that you're on a planet ruled by apes and you realize you're going to be used as as pets. So I kind of appreciate seeing that unfold with someone so new, because it's like, how would you react? Honestly, if you just showed up and popped into this other world, like, I think I would have gotten killed already. So... but yeah, that's where I kind of leave it at that. Did you have like a particular relationship that you enjoyed the most seeing?
I thought actually that the connection between Brent and Nova was well established. It worked well. Inevitably, Cornelius and Zira, I think, worked well. And equally, on another side, the relationship between Zaius and Ursus. And if you take Robin's Trump analogy, you can say, yes, obviously it was Zaius who effectively proved that it was just an illusion. That actually there wasn't the lawgiver wasn't actually bleeding, and the fires weren't actually there. There was falseness there as they went into the desert. Very much a biblical metaphor for so many religious revelations and aspects that we see within that.
Well, and it's funny that you also said Trump too, because I was thinking Trump when that came up as well. Kind of watching this, but then also. Maybe it's because it's my most recent experience of trying to compare between a character I know so recently. But you can kind of go with any kind of dictator when you think about it, you know, any side, anyone that has to use a certain form of propaganda or a certain form of storytelling to get the audience on their side or get the majority of the audience on their side, especially in such a cynical kind of way. I mean, it's very, you have to read between the lines, and I think we've all gotten very used to doing that. I mean, for us on the outside perspective, you're like, oh, that's crazy, that's so strong. But you know, it's like, no, we've seen it. All it is the right kind of truth to back you up, I guess.
Well, as I say, it's another world leader with a five-letter surname, but I think Putin also shows some aspects of Ursus as well. Curiously, also five letters as well. Maybe there's a trend that's coming through on that. Still, all things bright and beautiful. First time I've actually heard this sung or crippled in such a way. It seemed to remind me of certain karaoke sessions I've experienced at Lincoln in terms of the way they actually did for that particular aspect. Robin, you've never experienced that, and I pray for your sake you never have to.
Never experienced karaoke in my life. I avoid karaoke like a vampire avoids holy water, and I always will.
That's one of the reasons, Kathy, that Robin would be rarely able to join us on our after-show gigs when we're doing the Midweek Drive live. But let's move on to the images of New York. I thought it was interesting that we had Radio City Music Hall, obviously portrayed there, the ruins of Radio City Music Hall, the RKO sort of box there, plus, of course, the library, the Congress, the bank, and, of course, Queensboro Station. Did any of those icons strike you as being as iconic as obviously the positioning, as we saw revealed in the opening tease, or the end of the first movie, the beginning of the second, of Taylor's experience of the Statue of Liberty?
What struck me, having been in New York, is that all these places seem to be within a couple of feet of each other. It wasn't like walk in and you see one landmark. Walk a bit further and you see something else. Walk a bit further. It was like, you turn your head and there's the Library of Congress. Turn your head and there's something. Turn your head and there's something. And they all seem to be on the same block, and they're not.
Maybe they were all pushed together over the centuries. They were
by the seismic quakes caused by the nuclear. Yeah, okay, we'll go with that. We'll go with that.
No, we can argue this. We have evidence of how things are spread out historically because of archaeologists, and they're never quite so close. In fact, some would argue it takes a lifetime to find certain things. So I think they could have spent the extra 5 minutes to separate them.
But then again, those places that you describe, Kathy, mm-hmm. aren't still inhabited.
True. I mean, It's here's the thing, though, because I've been going to New York every year since I was born. And when I read Queensboro Plaza, and I know how long it would take just to get on a subway to get to the destination, they were saying, like, Statue of Liberty, you're like, that is still a distance.
would it be equivalent to
challenge, okay? I will give you $1 in cash if the next time you're in Queensboro Plaza, you do a gorilla walk and I get visual evidence. $1 cash.
Sounds like a TikTok challenge though, Kathy. But let's move on to let's move on to the notion of favorite characters and so on. We've had aspects of the music as well from that perspective. Kathy, where are you going to go in terms of your character that you would maybe like to have a cup of water with, as long as it wasn't poisonous water from a well outside a church?
Okay, so I apologize because I can't remember the names of certain characters because, you know, they add up quickly and it's my first viewing. But the apes that side with the human, the woman, how quickly, I just appreciate how on top of her head she was, being like, I'm going to utilize the situation to just make everything easier. She's still a little stubborn, so she lets her personality show. So, which is hard being, you know, you are an ape in this situation. Like, the fact that I already humanized with that person immediately, I was like, okay, so who is she?
That would be Zira, played by Kim Hunter, of course. And I know you spoke last week about the foreshadowing that we saw manifest. There's also a significant foreshadowing here with respect to the fact that we find that Zira is indeed carrying a young infant ape as well, that will obviously manifest itself in the next three movies in many ways. So Zira for yourself. Robin, what about yourself?
If you had asked me about any other apes movie, it would have been Roddy McDowall, because of the way he can emote through that heavy, heavy makeup. I would like to give a mention to Natalie Trundy, who debuted in the Ape series in this as the female mutant, would return to Escape from the Planet of the Apes as an animal psychologist, would return again in Conquest and Battle.
It helps if you're married to one of the studio executives, Robin.
Yeah, but she did a good job in all three roles, I thought. But unusually, and not for the misogynistic reasons you guys are going to think, and you as well, dear listener, I'm going to go with Nova. Why? I've been very harsh with Nova in Planet of the Apes because she was literally nothing but set dressing. She served no purpose. She was just there looking blankly at Charlton Heston while he chewed the scenery like he always does. I mean, it doesn't matter what film you put Charlton Heston in, he's always going to be acting like Moses. But in this film, she actually has useful stuff to do. In fact, she is the catalyst for most of the film. Now, she managed to emote and mime a bit better than she did in the first one. And when she gets shot, you know, I really felt, I thought, like, oh no, not Nova, because she's the one who brings everybody together to propel the plot forward. And it can't be that easy acting with, you know, as many macho males, with Kim Hunter out of most of the scenes, because Cornelius and Zira are pretty much background characters and only there for the first half of the movie. But I think it's also worth mentioning that despite my sort of backing of Nova in this film, neither Charlton Heston nor James Franciscus, nor any of them, their characters really affect the plot or really its outcome, because the apes were going to go to war with the humans in the Forbidden Zone anyway, and if the apes hadn't caused the utter destruction, then the mutants were certainly going to. So, you know, it's kind of, they didn't affect the outcome. It may well have been Charlton Heston's hand that hit the button at the end, but if he hadn't, I feel absolutely certain that somebody else would.
And curiously, I also felt that the role of Nova in this particular episode was particularly well structured and well put together. I think Linda Harrison, who would, of course, go on to appear in Cocoon in 1985, was a good and competent, well, more than competent, sort of way of actually dealing with a case of having to emote with anything other than effectively body language or nonverbal communication. And her concern and indeed bravery, I think, was very appropriate for that perspective. Although I would put in a special nod in the direction of James Franciscus as the character of Brent, because pretty much at the same time, he'd also been a part of a movie which, again, we may consider in a future Resonance Rewind, even though it didn't do a great deal at the box office at the time. It starred Gene Hackman as well as Gregory Peck. It was a movie called Marooned, in which James Franciscus played one of the astronauts who was, as the name suggests, literally marooned in orbit around the Earth and so on, in a an eerie foreshadowing of Apollo 13, actually. But that's another story.
The first sci-fi movie I saw in the cinema, I was about 9.
Then, in which case, Marooned will come through. But that has brought us neatly round to, of course, the scores, in which, although we are slightly fewer in number than normal, and hopefully the team will be growing back for other sort of systems, etc. Kathy, what are you going to go for this particular Resonance Rewind for Beneath the Planet of the Apes?
I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. 8 out of 10 for me. I feel really good about it. I was entertained all the way through. And then I just really like that it made you think a little bit more. So I'm giving it an 8.
It's a small, insignificant green planet which has suddenly died. The very downbeat ending of the movie, which also, for me, probably gets an 8 as well. So, Robin?
Well, it made me think so much. And I've enjoyed these Apes movies so much this week. You're not going to believe it. I'm going to go with a 9.
This is good stuff. I mean, again, I'm vacillating between that. I might even go 8.5 and sort of split the difference.
You are parting these scores like Heston parted the Red Sea.
Indeed. From Beneath the Planet of the Apes, we move back to series television next week, in which we'll be exploring John Steed and Tara King, played by Linda Thorson, as opposed to his earlier partner of Emma Peel, or indeed Kathy Gale, played respectively by Diana Rigg and Honor Blackman. We'll be exploring something which I gather Robin actually was traumatized by as a child. It's set in a everyday vicarage with architects obviously exploring the underground ruins of this particular aspect, and they're having to deal with a very strange, very eerie thing that's actually called Thingamajig. So that was the next adventure for Resonance Rewind. It's The Avengers, a 6th season episode, Thingamajig. For now, to Robin Pierce, to Kathy Manso, and to you, dear listener, keep on resonating.
That's like a man! That weapon is built by man! You can't shoot it down with only a clip of bullets!
We can't shoot it down, we'll pull it down! Rope! Rock and tackle! Get out!
You don't know what you're doing!
It'll kill us all!
Taylor! me?
You ask me to help you? Man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction.
The countless billions of galaxies in the universe lies a medium-sized star, and one of its satellites, a green and insignificant planet, is now dead.